on his last transmission wasn't making it. So you were talking about eliminating the loading coils or bypassing them or something along those lines, Dave. I'm not recommending that. You've got to start off with a good physical inspection. To have a standing wave ratio that high on a commercially made antenna rated for those frequencies, at alpha, delta, DXCC, is made for 80 through 10 meters. And on the 40 meter band, to be that bad, and be bad on a couple of other bands, but on 40 to be that bad, there's a direct short circuit or open circuit. Back to you, Steve, for any further comments on this one. KD2HUC, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, I will heed that advice, and I will go and I will check both coils and make sure that they're clean, and I'll take resistance measurements, and presumably online I should be able to find out what the actual Henry rating of them should be, and I can take those measurements. And I'll take it from there and see if I can isolate this problem. I will be back next week if I don't solve this issue. KD2HEC, back to that.
There's also one other possibility. After you do your full physical inspection, if you don't see something obvious, then there's the capacitor that's inside that coil, a short or an open or whatever. I'd like to believe somewhere in the world on that exact antenna, the 80 alpha delta dash DXCC, that somebody knows that with a grid dip meter, what each one of those coils should resonate at. Quite possibly Hal will have a hint along these lines. K6DPZ, K2RIW, go ahead Hal. I'm pretty sure Hal wanted to give us some further information. So, we'll be looking forward to hearing from you next week, Steve, as to what you discover. Don't give up on this one. But the good news is that when something is that bad, troubleshooting it sometimes becomes easier. You don't have just a minor mistuning. You've got a direct short or open circuit or a missing component, an open junction, something along those lines, to get that bad. And roughly, how many watts were you running when you got that arc over condition, Steve? KD2HUC, K2RIW in the TechNet?
I have a comment, K6TPZ.
I would say upwards of between 50 and 70 watts, somewhere thereabouts. And what was interesting was I assume the capacitance of my body changed it, because it became more pronounced if I let go of the knob. Pretty interesting effect. KD2HEC, back to that.
Yeah, super high VisWaz will do that. And so that question I asked you, Hal, with reference to a grid dip meter, I wonder if you've got an answer on that one. K6DPZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Sorry, WHSNF, K6TPC. Okay, first of all, if he's arcing over the upturner, he's looking into an infinitely high impedance, not low impedance. I would say he should take the inside of the connector and the outside of the connector, run an ohmage test so that he doesn't have to open on that line. Sounds like the coax is open on one leg of that antenna, and that's why the impedance is all the way into infinite, Dick. That's number one.
He's getting a reasonably good VisWaz on some of the bands. That would suggest the coax is not open. Over to you, Hal.
Do you measure the ohmic and see if it's correct? Because you can have one side, but then you still may get a visually good VSWR using a tuner. He may have the shield open, he may still be resonating the whole piece of wire again.
Okay, so Steve is going to be doing a complete inspection. So Hal is recommending that you do an ohmmeter test to be sure the semiconductor from bottom to top and the shield from bottom to top are really making contact. The way some people do that is to open up the connector at the antenna and backtrack, make sure a semiconductor to shield, you measure an open circuit, then create create a short circuit at the antenna end between center conductor and shield. And back in the shack, you should see a short circuit. So I do recommend an open and short ohmmeter test on the cable as you do the inspection of the antenna itself. So if that makes some sense, Steve, KD2HUC, K2RIW in the tech net.
It certainly does, and, you know, I'll do that. After I installed and terminated the cable, I did that. I did a mega test to make sure that there was no leaky insulation between the center, the center conductor and shield, and I did test it for continuity. But the pipe does go underground, so maybe a couple of the local rodents attacked my heliac. So I have no problems doing it again. It's about 5 minutes worth of work. KD2HUC, I thank everybody for their advice, and I will let you know. Back to that.
Very fine, Steve. Good luck with that operation. And I've got a gut feeling you're going to get it in operation, but you're going to find some silly error of the kinds that we've been discussing. Okay, that was everybody on our list. I'm not sure whether or not John is available tonight, but I'll pass it over to him just in case he is. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Over to you, John, if you're there. Okay, I think John is not there tonight, and we do miss him. Looking forward to when he comes back. And Paul, NASA's been busy. The space agencies have been busy. And I'm still shocked by what you told us last week about all of the number of things that are in orbit around planet Earth, the number of companies, the number of countries, the number of space agencies that are all busy building equipment and ready to launch it. Wow. I used to think that NASA does almost all the work. Boy, are they getting competition. WS2N. The space report number 220, I think it is. K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul.
WS2N 220. And they're used to the competition. You know, they had Russia to start with. So, you know, the ball really got rolling back in the late 50s and 60s. Now everybody else has jumped on the bandwagon, including the commercial companies. So you have quite a few of them, and ground support companies is a commercial company developing spacesuits and equipment that will they plan on eventually selling to not only NASA but to anybody that wants to buy them. So commercial industry is really kicking in. Some of them are starting to make profits, and I think you're going to see a lot of launches. We won't be able to keep up with them. As it is, we can't keep up with them. I don't mention every launch that goes up. To, let me drop it. And this week we don't have that many launches to talk about because there's been some delays. Anybody that's been following the space program knows that SpaceX is temporarily out of the ball game because of Falcon 9 that blew up September 1st on the launch pad. It wasn't even going to take off. They were just doing a static test, firing the engines, making sure everything was okay. And 2 days later, they were going to launch it. In fact, they were launching a satellite for Israel. And it blew up on a launch pad during a test. They loaded all the propellants into it and all the fuel and oxygen. And they were a couple of minutes, I think 8 minutes away from testing that rocket when all of a sudden it blew up. They're still investigating that problem. They seem to have worked the problem down to the helium lines or tank that is located in the second stage of that rocket, but they haven't come up with a definitive course yet, a source of ignition and all, so they're working on that. And they made a statement that they plan on launching in November, at the end of November, which is fine. You know, they think they could launch from Vandenberg Air Force Base. They're ready for that. They have a planned launch with Iridium, 10 Iridium satellites to go up. I don't see how they can launch without knowing definitively what the problem was.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Some other delays going on as well. The next crew to the International Space Station, they're on delay. Rocket, Soyuz rocket that's supposed to have launched on the 23rd of this month was delayed because of technical problems. They had the whole thing put together. You know, they're putting the fairing around the Soyuz spacecraft, the manned spacecraft getting ready to launch from Kazakhstan. And they ran a test, they have run a lot of tests, and they found some kind of short circuit. The information hasn't been really released yet on what that short circuit is, or, you know, it's an anomaly. They just, I don't even know if they know what it is or where it is. But they apparently believe they found it. They're making a prediction for launch on the beginning of November. So that changes things out a little bit. The next crew is supposed to be coming back on October 30th. So that means they're going to have a little bit of an extended stay. And that includes a Russian and an American. The American is Dr. Kate Rubin. And the only American on board. There's only three people on board the space station right now. A fellow from Japan and a Russian and our American astronaut. So we'll see if this thing gets up. It goes up on time. She has the capability of staying up there till February, if need be.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
But the commercial end of things is still underway. There's a lot of things that we talked about last week that are still going ahead full blast. Virgin Galactic is gearing up. They've already run a carry test on their White Knight 2. So the next step for them is to actually release that new spacecraft and see if it flies and then lands, and they'll do that a number of times before they actually drop it and light the engine. Let me drop it. This is WS2X. So that's pretty much it for missions that are currently going. I know John wanted to talk about updates on New Horizon. We'll wait for him to come back, and we'll give that. The Mars rover is still under development for the United States. We plan on launching Mars 2020 rover. And the last thing I read on that, which was about a couple of days ago, that it's going well. And there's no delays involved with that. Interesting experiment they have on board. This one, compared to Mars Curiosity, is oxygen reclaim device. They call it MOXIE. You know, that's another acronym. But MOXIE is going to take the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere on Mars and eliminate the carbon and create oxygen, and they want to be able to see if they can do this on a small scale. You know, through chemistry, they know it will work, but will it really work on Mars? You know, send the unit up and see if you could actually get oxygen. And, you know, if there was an astronaut there, you know, would he be able to breathe it? He could, but not for long. They're only going to be able to produce a very small amount of oxygen. Just to give you an idea, this small unit, which is about 9 inches in diameter, and I think about 15 inches long, would only create one-tenth of the amount of oxygen that you would need to produce.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Be a big unit. I mean, the thing as it is, eats up over 300 watts of power, so I can imagine what a full-scale Moxie unit would do. But nevertheless, you got to start somewhere, and that's where they're going to start. And Strato Launch was in the news recently. They're changing some of their personnel up on top because they're getting to the point they're getting away from the development stage and close to operation stage for Strato Launch. Strato Launch is a company that's developing the world's largest plane as far as wingspan goes to eventually bring rockets up to 55,000 feet and let them go and eventually go into orbit or wherever they would like to put them. So we'll see how Strato Launch does in the near future. That's pretty much it for now, Dick. There's other small items, but if you want to get to it, we can. K2RIWWS2N for the SpaceNet report on the TechNet.
Very fine, Paul. You're coming through quite well, although you did time out the machine a few times, and we did a couple of things to reset it, if you know what I mean, so that we didn't lose more than a couple of seconds of what you're saying. Got a couple of questions. Throughout the history of the International Space Station, I think the maximum number of people they've ever had on board is something like 7. I wonder what is the minimum, because of the delayed launching of people about to go back up, and some of the people that are there have to come back down. I think we can get down to a fairly low number, and will there always be enough Soyuzes to come home if there's an emergency, is one of my questions. But you mentioned that the female astronaut who's there now is supposed to leave by February, or has to leave by February, if she has an extended mission. Is there a reason why she has to leave by February, or is that just her scheduled leave? But tell me about the maximum and number and the minimum number. If for a short period of time you had to go down to 0 people on board, would the International Space Station be safe in that mode? Is everything on board automated enough, or do the astronauts on board have to do some form of continuous resetting of things from day to day? WS2N, K2RIW, you got a ball.
Yeah, there's a lot of maintenance that goes on board the space station. You know, you have a normal crew of 6, and with that, you get around 45 hours of science that comes back, 45 hours worth of science per week. So that means all those other hours dedicated to maintaining the spacecraft, which involves spacewalks, and the average, you might get, 100 hours 1 week, but the average is 40 hours of science, and that's why they need to eventually send another, and you make it a 7-person crew. And that might not happen for a while. You asked about Kate Rubin. Yeah, she was supposed to come back October 30th. Let me drop it. Trying to avoid timing out. So that's a scheduled time to come back. She's been up there quite a few months already. So, but she can go up to February. Not so much her, but the spacecraft that she went up in, they have a 200, I think a 200. 2003 STS-107 Columbia accident when I think unfortunately burnt up in the atmosphere and they lost their crew. So they did go down to two because it was a long time before the shuttle could be put back into operation. So the maximum number of people that were ever on a space station was 13. So, you know, this is in the construction of it. I believe it's STS-127. And I know there's a good picture of everybody in one module getting their picture taken at the same time. So, you know, naturally they all weren't sleeping on board. You know, they had sleeping quarters on board the shuttle. That's most people actually that they ever had in space at one time. Another time when you had a large amount of people on the space station and also other people in space at the same time. I believe it was a space shuttle mission that was not scheduled to go to the space.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I think you had two on the way in a Soyuz spacecraft going up to the space station, so it was something like that. But 13 actually on board the ISS at one time. I probably timed it out. WS flight.
Yes, you did, but we reset it. 13. But that's with the shuttle attached, and of those 13 people, a certain number of them were assigned to the shuttle and go back down with it. I'm going to guess something like four. So of the 13 people, something like eight or nine were left on the station, not Paul. Is that roughly true? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, well, they probably brought back eight that trip. I'll have to look at STS-127. And, but then you had people that were leaving, that would be leaving on a progress spacecraft. Sometimes they, see, right now it's set where six generally is up there, and then three go down and three come up. For a while what they were doing, they would have six on board. Soyuz would come up, you would have nine, and then the other three would go back down. For some reason, they got away from that. It has to do with scheduling, I think. You know, or if there's delays, you know, it gets complicated with the scheduling. But a lot of times, you had like nine, so you might have had nine there, and you know, half a dozen from the space shuttle, and then maybe board seven down. But, I don't know. It's going to get a little different once you have the commercial crews going up. You have the Starliner being built by Boeing, and you have Dragon being built by SpaceX, and each flight will contain four people. By having four people come up instead of the standard three that you have on a progress, they'll be able to have a total of seven people on board. So you know, you always need a seat for somebody in case there's an emergency. We all have to abandon ship, so that would leave, let's say, one Soyuz attached with three, and a Starliner by Boeing with four. So you'd have a group of seven people on board, and that's what they're looking to do, because then they would have enough people to do a lot more science. They say double the amount of science that they're getting back. Now, the problem is, just recently, like last week, I talked about this like a month or two ago, but they confirmed it last week in Russia, that they want to cut back from three to two, and that's going to happen sometime next year, 2017 March. Let me drop it. once that happens, now you're back to a two, to a five-person crew on board. And then, you know, you'll go back up to six because, you know, the Dragon and Starliner will come online on a regular basis in 2018. But that one-year period of time, looks like a little over 1 year, you might have a crew of five instead of six, which is interesting. You know, you'll still have an empty seat, but there aren't too many people right now willing to pay the $50 million to get on board the Soyuz to go up. So they're not going to be able to fill that seat, and they don't want to fill it with a Russian because that's what they're complaining about. The cost is getting to be too much. Now, if the Russians could get this new module, MLM, they call it multi-purpose logistics module, launched another big, you know, module, probably 35 feet long, and a little shorter than that, 14 feet in diameter, and then have that attached to the space station. Then they'll have more crew quarters, they'll have a big working laboratory with more science that they could do, and then they could have a standard crew of three. So, but, you know, these things are very, very, that's the idea now. Let me drop it.
Paul, did you say that the Soyuz usually launches three people and they're going to start launching only two for some reason? And what's the reason for that? I mean, when it comes to cost, the majority of the cost is operating the booster and everything else, and putting one more human being on there seems like a minor delta in cost.
Repeater, time out.
So I'm a little bit confused about that. Back to you, Paul. And be careful about the timeouts.
Yeah, no, I got my HT on, but I take myself out. I gotta put an antenna in another room or something. We'll see. You're gonna have two people coming up. The cost is, you're going to be able to send up one less progress ship. Right now they send up an average of four progress ships a year. Now they'll be able to send up three. So that's a very costly procedure, sending up a whole rocket. And they can cut back on that. That's what they're definitely going to do now. Unless the MLM gets up there, and then they'll have another bathroom, another big, huge laboratory, a functioning laboratory that's been built delayed since 2007, so it's almost 10 years. But they do expect to get that up probably the end of 2017, maybe 2018. 2018 is going to be a big year. A lot of things are going to happen in that. I can't believe how many things are supposed to be coming around in 2018. Back to you, Dick.
You want Golf Alpha Juliet? Blank 1 Golf Alpha Alpha Juliet. Give me your full call and your name, sir, and then proceed.
Call is W1 Golf Alpha Juliet, Whiskey 1 Golf Alpha Juliet. Name is David. We're in Brooklyn, New York. Just need a quick signal report. Trying out a new antenna.
Your signal is good and clean, David. No problem. Paul, you said a couple of occasions in your last couple of transmissions, three people can go up on Progress. I wonder if you meant Soyuz. I thought Progress was primarily a cargo ship. I didn't know it's used for manned launches. I may be confused on that one. WS2N, K2R.
Repeater, timeout.
You've got a ball.
Yeah, the reason I'm saying Progress, they're only cargo. But if you have a two-person crew that you're supporting with those cargo ships, you don't need to send up four cargo ships a year. You only need to send up three cargo ships or three progress ships per year. That's what I'm saying, Dick. And the Soyuz is three people only. And the Russians aren't dragging their feet. By the way, they're developing another spacecraft to replace Soyuz, called the Federation.
got a an Elon Musk vehicle. Who's and right now in the lineup of vehicles that are capable of bringing up human beings? And currently, you've got Soyuz. We used to have shuttle. Shuttle no longer exists. And I think very soon we're going to have some Elon Musk vehicles. And who after that? In the order in which you think it's going to happen, manned transport to the International Space Station. Tell me a little bit about that, Sam Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, and you have a lot of different ones for cargo. In fact, you have one that was retired by European Space Agency called the ATV, and that was a monster. That was a big one. Shame they stopped that one. But manned manned spacecraft, the only manned spacecraft that have attached to the International Space Station so far are Soyuz and the shuttle. Right now, of course, the only one we have is the Soyuz. Shuttle, like you said, has been discontinued back in 2011. And that is now going to be replaced by two manned spacecraft that now have contracts with NASA, and they're both commercial. And one is the Dragon Crew version that's, again, well under development. I expect to see that go up as early as late 2017. And that will be able to carry a crew of four. And the first flight will carry two people. One will be an NASA astronaut. The other one will be a commercial astronaut from SpaceX. Let me drop it. The next company is Boeing, and they have the Starliner. It used to be called the CST-100. Now it's called the Starliner. Again, well under development. Also, will be able to carry four people, and also probably in the 2018 timeframe, will be docking with the International Space Station. So you'll have three vehicles that will be able to do that. And which one will come first? I was betting on the Dragon. Now I'm a little concerned because of this explosion on the launch pad, Launch Complex 40, a couple of weeks ago on September 1st. That, you know, they got to figure out what the problem is and get that fixed. And then maybe I'll bet on them going up first. But right now, if there's any kind of heavy delays or have to redesign something, then I'm going to go with Boeing. You know, they're going to be launching on the Atlas rocket, Atlas 5. After that, let me drop it. There's no other crewed vehicles scheduled to go up. Eventually, if the space station is in operation beyond 2024, which I expect it to be, then you'll probably see Federation spacecraft going up from Russia. Not launched on a Soyuz anymore, but launched on an Angara rocket. Angara is the new rocket for Russia. That will be launching out of Vostochny, the east coast of Russia, which they've launched one rocket there so far as a test, make sure everything worked good, and it did. So then after that, providing Dream Chaser, which is being built by Sierra Nevada Corporation, another private company. We drop it. Is successful with their cargo. They have a cargo contract with NASA, and they'll be flying in probably 2019, maybe the earliest, or maybe 2020, if things are delayed, with their cargo vehicle called the Dream Chaser. Dream Chaser will take off on top of an Atlas rocket that Boeing and Lockheed will provide them under the name ULA, United Launch Alliance, and it's going to be a cargo vehicle. It's going to carry a lot of weight, too. Over 10,000 pounds of stuff, from what I read, up to the space station. Now, if that goes well, they still have another vehicle called the crewed Dream Chaser. Actually started out that way. Their contract got knocked down with NASA. They didn't make it. NASA chose two companies, Boeing and SpaceX, for crewed missions. But they're still developing it. You never know if the cargo missions work out. They're already guaranteed. Let me drop it. Already guaranteed six flights by NASA. NASA's going to pay for six flights. So that's in the bag for them to launch six flights to the space station. If they come up with another, funding that NASA is willing to put out to have another vehicle with a crew on board, I'm sure they would be probably first in line to do that, and you'd be able to have crew actually going up on a Dream Chaser to the space station. That would be pretty cool, because they come down and land, and they don't even need to land in Florida. They could land in California or even on any kind of an airport. Looks like a very small shuttle. Give you an idea what that thing looks like. Back to you, Dick. WS1.
Here comes kind of a crazy set of questions, Paul. When it comes to what NASA is talking about for the far future, European Space Agency, I think we even heard some words from Japan, China, and India. A number of countries have talked about going to Mars. The moon is 250,000 miles. Mars, when you land on it, is going to be roughly 300 million miles away. So we're talking about 1,000 times further in distance than the moon. You take the diameter of the Earth, you multiply it by 30. That's the distance one way to the moon. You multiply that by 1,000, and you get roughly the distance to Mars. So going to Mars is at least 1,000 times more difficult for a bunch of reasons compared to going to the moon. And the Apollo program to go to the moon was $33 billion in 1970 money. Let me drop it. So each of these nations that would like to have that feather in their cap are sending their astronauts to Mars. You and I have already discussed on multiple occasions how difficult, how expensive. Of all the articles you've written about a Mars landing of human beings, what's the best argument any country, any company, or whatever has ever used as to why? We want to send man to Mars, why? What's the best answer that you've ever heard of, Paul? WS2N, K2IW.
That's a tough question, because the best answer that's out there, is the difference between what the best answer is and what my opinion is. And I don't like to give my opinion. I'm not a reporter, but I believe in just telling you what's going on in the past and what they plan on doing in the future. But what I think is the best is, I think it's irrelevant. I'm surprised by so many different things. Just like you're surprised by the things I've been telling you in recent weeks. How many people countries and companies that are involved. They surprise me. They come out of the woodwork every day. Which ones are going to make it? Elon Musk, he wants to, this is September, right? He's supposed to be down in Guatemala. They're having a big meeting down there, all the space consortiums and countries. Let me drop it. having this meeting as planned probably for over a year in Guatemala and Mexico. And 6 months ago, they said Elon Musk would make a statement on his plans, his future plans, which of course involve Mars, and how he's going to get there. I mean, he's going to use this Mars colonial transport system, and, you know, we know little dribs and drabs about what he has planned, but he's supposed to give his, of course, his Mars report this month. So we're at the end of September. I'm sure that's probably going to come out shortly. We'll have that on the net. But, you know, his goal is to send millions of people to Mars. You know, he wants to establish a colony there, you know, hundreds at a time every time you launch one of these things. Now, he's not the only one that's involved with this. Now you got Jeff Bezos. I think I talked about him a couple of weeks ago. He's the one that owns Amazon.com, but he's the one that's been developing the new Shepard suborbital launch vehicle. 700 some odd people have already signed up to take these suborbital flights out from New Mexico. And now he's developed this new rocket that should test fly probably 2019, is his prediction, out of Florida, Launch Complex 36 that they're now leasing from the government. And this rocket that they're building down in Florida and launching from Florida is going to be called the New Glenn. Now, the New Glenn is a large rocket. You know, we have the SLS that NASA is developing, and it has a diameter of a little over 27 and a half feet on the core stage. The New Glenn has a diameter of 23 feet, so it's not too much different. Let me drop it. His goal, he's already said it, he wants millions of people into space, and that's his statement. And he's got this rocket that's being developed, and we'll see fly. On top of that, the first stage is going to be reusable. He wants to do the same thing that Elon Musk is doing, fly them and land them on a boat out in the ocean. So, when is this going to happen? That would be a better question. I think the earliest you're going to see any kind of thing in orbit, people in orbit, not landing, but in orbit around Mars, is going to be, I'm going to go with 2034 by NASA on the SLS system, space launch system that we're developing. First rocket test will probably be, again, 2018. So, end of 2018. We'll see that go up. Unmanned. That'll be an unmanned flight, but the spacecraft will go up. And I think that will be the beginning for us to see actual people getting to Mars, whether they land there or not. It's anybody's guess how far off that is. It's a big difference between orbiting, setting up a space station type setup. Big difference between that and then landing. Back to you, Dan.
Mars has an atmospheric pressure of 0.6% of Earth pressure. I don't know yet, but I'm about to find out. At what altitude on Earth would you get that air pressure? And the answer might be 100,000 feet. So on the surface of Mars, the air pressure might be something like the Earth, what air pressure is like on Earth at 100,000 feet. I don't have to tell you that if you suddenly open up the face plate on your spacesuit at 100,000 feet, your level of consciousness is going to fade real fast. It's very unhealthy. So if you're putting hundreds of people on Mars and they can't use, let me drop it. They're really going to have to live in spacesuits. You can't use the local atmosphere per se. You have almost no water. The good news is you got one third of Earth gravity or something like that. to grow food. I mean, the Martian, the movie The Martian, would lead you to believe that if you're very crafty, you can grow food in the Martian soil. Now, that's a speculation. Does the soil really contain the right minerals? And where's the air pressure going to come from? You talked about that machine that can take carbon monoxide on Mars and subtract the oxygen from it. But there's a darn little atmosphere, there's a darn little air pressure. How much carbon monoxide are you going to get? You're going to get in to get the oxygen back out. And the oxygen, when you get it back out, you have to spend quite a number of watts to do the separation. Energy, power is required. Then you have to take that oxygen you get and compress it more than 100 to 1. That's 130 to 1 or something like that, to bring it up to the atmospheric pressure that a human being is used to on the surface of the Earth. That takes a lot of energy. And a human being breathes a lot of cubic meters of air every day. So, if you've got hundreds of people on Mars, what are they going to do there? That's it. Let me drop. It's very nice to say you're going to set up a colony. What's the colony going to do? What's the future generations of that colony going to do? I mean, the science fiction stories about terraforming, where you apply some really high power engineering principles, and you take an inert planet and make it into a living environment. Nice science fiction, but where does the raw materials of water, oxygen, carbon, plants, atmosphere, energy, where does all the raw materials come from that you didn't bring with you? And every pound of stuff you bring to Mars, guarantee it's more than $1 million per pound to get something from the Earth to Mars. So, hundreds of people in a so-called colony doing what? Maybe I'm overly negative, but you can see what I'm worried about here. KQRS2N, KQRIW, make it sound more desirable if you can, Paul.
Well, that's Elon Musk, you know, that's his vision, not mine, but that's his, you know, he wants to set up, he wants to have a two-planet system, so, I guess if anything goes seriously wrong here, maybe we'll have enough people there to continue the species. Kind of like heard that, I don't know if you quoted that or other people have quoted him. But that's neither here nor there. The same with NASA. You know, our goal is right now is to get to Mars with people. For years, we've got these robots riding around, decades, and you know we're getting plenty of information out of that. But it's nothing like sending people. And you know, what are they going to do there? The idea, eventually, of course, is to settle a planet. And good luck with that. It's going to go beyond our time. By the way, the oxygen, it takes 300 watts. They have to heat up the gas in this contraption, this MOXIE. It actually stands for Mars Oxygen In Situ Resource Utilization Experiment. That's on board the Mars 20 rover. And that's going to produce 35 hundredths of an ounce. And they gave it in grams. It's 10 grams. 10 grams per hour. And like I said before, it's supposed to be a 1 to 100 ratio of what you would really need. You know, you'd have to scale this thing up 100 times to make it efficient for human use. And they don't say how many people, how many humans. So, operating at 300 watts.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Back to you, sir.
So this produces a couple of ounces, I think you said, or a couple of grams of oxygen per hour. A human being breathes roughly a meter of air 20 times per minute. That's 1,500 times per hour, if I did the math right. So, roughly 1,000 liters per hour of air goes through the lungs of a human being, a very rough number. And this machine would have to operate for, by the way, let's see now, 1,000 liters of air, I think that is exactly a cubic meter. A cubic meter of air is 2.7 pounds. So, a human being breathes something like 2.7 pounds of air per hour. Very rough numbers. And this machine that you're describing at 300 watts of energy consumption is making an extremely small fraction of that. So just the energy required to gather the oxygen to keep the human being alive on Mars, that alone is going to require a pretty large array of solar cells, because you don't get anywhere near as much solar light on Mars. Let me drop it. You're starting to see the raw materials required here just to continuously have a supply of local oxygen. You're going to have a great big field of solar cells gathering enough energy to run the machine that's subtracting the oxygen from the carbon dioxide of this very thin atmosphere. And all of that is just for one human being. And so if you're going to send hundreds of human beings, you've got to multiply all of that by hundreds of times. And if that machinery hiccups and stops making oxygen, life gets pretty complicated pretty fast. Colonizing the moon is 1,000 times easier than colonizing Mars, at least 1,000 times easier. And we've already had some discussions about colonizing Mars, or colonizing the moon. How difficult would that be? Just the raw temperature of the moon, day to night, is huge, life-threatening, and there's absolutely no air there on Mars, on the moon. Maybe in those craters at the North Pole you'll find some water, and maybe you can do some, let me drop it. You can do some electrolysis to subtract the hydrogen and oxygen from that water. So at least the oxygen, a major ingredient you've got. And where the nitrogen is going to come from, I mean, the atmosphere that we breathe is primarily 80% nitrogen, 20% oxygen. And you'd like to have that exact same mixture at normal air pressure in your spacesuit on the surface of the moon. So even a moon colony is extremely difficult. It's a nice sounding goal. And almost every student in high school right now is dreaming about their belief that in their generation, one of their compatriots is going to be walking the surface of Mars, Moon, or whatever. It's a nice sounding goal, and to work toward that goal, there's some advantages. But if you look at the end of the goal, are those hundreds of people on Mars in this colony going to be multiplying and occupying the hold-on planet? The hold-on planet that has almost no air, absolutely almost no water, almost absolutely no food, because of no atmosphere, let me drop it. Because of no local magnetic field and no atmosphere, you're getting no protection from the solar wind and cosmic rays. That's a tough place to live. It takes an extremophile to try to even dream about staying alive there, as I see it, for any length of time, without bringing with you a tremendous amount of resources. You gotta find the places where I'm wrong here, boy. It can't be that negative with so many people thinking in this direction. WS2N, K2RIW.
Well, SpaceX plans on sending their first rocket to Mars just 2 years, it's 2018, the next window that opens up. And he plans on landing his Dragon crewed vehicle, without a crew, of course, on the planet. And he's already coordinated with NASA. NASA's going to let him use the deep space network. NASA's going to get the data that he gets out of his propulsion landing going to Mars. This thing is 10 times heavier than the heaviest thing we've put on Mars so far, which is the Curiosity rover. And you know the entry descent system that they had with that was very complicated. I was amazed that it worked. It came through with a parachute and this jetpack thing flying up above with a crane set up, lowering the Curiosity to ground, and all these cables had to cut precisely at the right time to, you know, wheels had to unfold before they touched the ground. And that thing weighed a ton, 2,000 earth pounds. Dragon is 10 times heavier than they're going to use the Super Draco engine to land. No parachute required. So they'll have a heat shield and propulsion engine. So I'll have a little bit better idea of how they're going to accomplish this in another year or so. And hopefully they get their act together with the Falcon 9. They plan on using the Falcon Heavy to launch this thing. That would be three Falcon 9s bolted together, take off from Launch Complex 39A in Florida, and see what happens. And he plans on bringing his own machines up there, maybe an oxygen generating machine as well. But there's a lot of test pieces of equipment that are being planned on that. Not being paid by us. You know, he's going to fit the bill. And they say $300 million just for him to do this on his own. So, what do you think? He's serious about what he's doing. He's putting all his money into it. He's going full blast. Wanted to say something else about what you said before, but I forgot. Back to you.
Yeah, hopefully you'll think of it, Paul. Wow. Of all the people listening to us right now, I am guessing quite a few of you have heard very positive sounding statements about NASA and other space agencies planning on going to Mars. I'll bet you guys have heard a lot of that. Tell me a little bit about what you've heard and what your impression is as to how prevalent that goal is among the current adults and near adults. It's my impression that the majority of our high school students who think about science think that the next major goal is Mars. Maybe a little bit of a stop on the moon just to test out some of the hardware, but Mars is a real goal. That's what I think I'm hearing. Give me a call letters if you've heard anything along these lines. I'd like to hear what you guys have heard. Give me a call letters. K2RIW in the Tech Man.
In 2MB.
Battery recognized. Anyone else? Okay. Hey, Barry.